Well, hello, and welcome back to the Tim Masso Podcast. Frankly, it's been a while. We thought we'd get Season 2 kicked off and running, and then, unfortunately, fate and life intervened, but I'm determined to get the series back on track, and I have some great guests coming up. William Messina is going to be talking about his work with Messina Lab, all of the collaborators who help him create the watches of his dreams for fellow collectors, and we're going to be speaking to Patek Philippe expert John Reardon about his new company, Collectability, which focuses on contemporary and vintage Patek Philippe watches. Today, I thought I would get back into the groove by talking about my own watch collecting, and I think we can be honest about those we love, and that includes watches. So I'm going to be constructively critical about some of the references that I love most and what I think is basically wrong with them on an essential level. I'll also say that this is a companion to my February 13th episode of Watches Tonight. So if you want to see and hear this narration, full images are available in that episode where you'll see the pictures of the watches I talk about as I talk about them. So with all of that said, YouTube is available. Let's dive right into this podcast. So even in a loving relationship, long-term experience proves that there's no such thing as a perfect union. Couples fight, feud, make threats, and separate. If it's meant to be, all of this can be overcome. And that's how I'm approaching today's discussion. Having reviewed over 10,000 watches and handled and experienced even more, I have a rare sense of perspective that permits easy assessment of the strengths and weaknesses of any watch. So when I turn a critical eye toward personal favorites, I need to be honest with myself. I'm still a critic with a withering analytical gaze, but I also know that these are watches for which I can forgive any transgression or shortcoming. Here are all the reasons I quote-unquote hate my favorite watches, and why, in each case, my love affair with these perfectly imperfect watches will endure. Let's start with one of the first watches I ever loved, which is the Rolex Daytona. You never forget your first. As a budding enthusiast of endurance racing in my late high school years, I watched the old U.S. Speed Vision channel, which was nothing but vintage Grand Prix's, old car movies, and endurance motorsports. There was no NASCAR, there was no F1, they didn't have the contracts for those, so I saw a lot of sports car racing, including the Rolex 24 Hours at Daytona. Now, for those who are not familiar with auto racing in the United States, the word Daytona brings to mind Confederate flags, high banks, left turns, giant crashes, all sorts of stuff that may or may not be the reality of modern-day NASCAR. But the Daytona 500, the NASCAR event, is very different from January's 24 Hours of Daytona, which is a around-the-clock road course that is left and right turn event staged by sports cars, or cars that are either racing versions of road cars or derived from road-going technology. In other words, they have a much more direct link to the kind of cars you can buy, as opposed to NASCAR or F1, where the car is basically just built for the track. So at the 24 Hours of Daytona, there are several different classes. There are production-based classes, where the cars are based on Porsche 911, BMW M4, Chevrolet Corvette, that sort of thing. And then there are the prototype classes, where the cars may use an engine or a transmission from a road-going manufacturer, but for the most part, these are purpose-built cars designed only for competition on the track. You can't buy one at your Cadillac or Acura dealership. So of these classes, and there's currently, I believe, three prototype classes and two production-based classes, there are five wins to be had. Each one of these cars, because it's a 24-hour race, will have 3 to 5 drivers, and each driver in each class-winning car gets the Rolex Daytona. It's been this way for a long time. Rolex has been a sponsor of the race since the 60s, and it's awarded each winning driver in each class-winning car a Rolex Cosmograph Daytona chronograph since the 1990s. And here's the thing. Advertising works. There were a lot of Rolex ads during those 24 hours of Daytona and all of the shorter format endurance races. This is a watch that captured my imagination because I was arguably a lot closer to affording a watch at the time than I was to owning and running a race team. And there's still a lot to love. At 40 millimeters in diameter and just over 12 millimeters thick, wonderfully immune to planned obsolescence. The Rolex Daytona is like a Porsche 911. Go back to 1963 and the first Rolex Daytonas, and they still are visibly related to the watch you can buy today. Go back to 1988, and it's almost exactly the same watch. The Daytona has been produced in its current six-digit Rolex generation since 2000. Before that, the last redesign was 1988, when we got the 40mm case, the full screw-down, the sapphire crystal, the automatic movement. Then it was based on a Zenith El Primero. Since 2000, it's been a Rolex caliber. I can't think of any watch that's gone that long, 1988 to the present, without a full-scale redesign, and it hasn't been redesigned. Everything that's changed has just been detail refinements. Rolex has redesigned every model line it has at least once since 2000. All your Divers, all your Oyster Perpetuals, your Air King, your Milgauss, which didn't even exist in the catalog in 2000, everything's been revised. The Daytona's startling aftermarket price premiums and authorized dealer wait list are the worst part of the Daytona experience. The hardware is fantastic. And frankly, I have to admit that the dealership experience is the first thing that I don't love about the Rolex Daytona. It's absurd for a watch to have a years-long wait list. I can't even imagine. Even worse, a lot of people who do get the first call, the first right to refuse, don't refuse. They buy the watch and they flip it. And you know what? I think that's fine. I think you pay your money, you get your watch. It's tough to bear, but it's a fact of life. So the first thing I don't like about the Rolex Daytona is that there's a lot of flipping and there's a lot of waiting. And if you must have it now, you're going to pay a ruinous markup. They're still trading in the mid to high 20s, and this is a watch that sells for $14,800. So that's still quite a markup, even if they're no longer trading at over 50 grand like they were in the spring of 2022. The lack of changes in the Daytona is the only case I know of Rolex clearly resting on its laurels and milking success for all it's worth. I would also say that given that the watch has changed so little, its price is escalating unreasonably for what you get. So in 2016, literally the same watch, the current 116500 LN steel case, full bracelet, ceramic bezel, it was $12,800. Now it's $14,800 for the exact same watch. All the tools are paid off. The styling hasn't changed since 1988. The movement has seen only detail refinements since 2000. Now, Rolex is not at the mercy of suppliers. It controls its own supply chain. So it's hard to claim the company is being gouged by suppliers. And also, Rolex is in Switzerland, so some of the most expensive entitlements that would be paid by employers in, say, the United States are actually provided by the Swiss government over there. So there's no way to understand the escalation in pricing other than Rolex milking an existing successful design for all it's worth on the market. That said, I still love the watch, and I'll give Rolex credit, because if you only account for inflation, $12,400 in 2016 money is over $15,100 in 2023 money. So the Daytona actually hasn't kept up with inflation in terms of retail pricing. So I give Rolex credit for that. I just regret that the price has increased much at all. And you know what? If you get a chance to buy it at retail, it's a bargain. They're still trading at 25 to 28 grand used in stainless steel. So heck, what do I know? Plenty of people are willing to wait. Plenty of people are willing to pay a premium. I just feel like the wait, the premium, and the lack of innovation are the worst features of the Rolex Daytona. Now, let's talk about a watch that's been on, well, my wish list and maybe the very top. Maybe it's been my grail since 2021. Everyone has a wish list, and then theoretically at the top of that wish list, there's a grail watch, a borderline unobtainable aspiration. It's the supercar you'd put in your imaginary wrist garage, so to speak. So the Patek Philippe 5236P, this is probably the watch I covet most right now. I've been obsessed with this reference since it debuted in 2021. The dial kills me with its satin grain brushed from top to bottom, smoked fumé color, that's a gradient dial or a vignette. It has an inline American-style calendar with a double-digit date and perfect balance. You cut this dial from top to bottom and each side bilaterally symmetrical, beautifully penned. Its movement combines both finish and architecture, so this 31-260 movement, it started life in the 5235 regulator, and it is a micro rotor, but it's not the 240. It's a more modern, larger movement. It has a wonderful combination of finish, which is how elements are decorated, and architecture, which is how elements are situated in relation to each other, how they're shaped, how they're proportioned. It's different from just letting the engineering fall where it does and then polishing. Architecture means you really need to think about the aesthetics of the movement from the very first engineering drawings. Lots to love there. It's been upgraded from the movement that you find in the 5235. It now has a platinum micro rotor for more winding efficiency versus gold in the annual calendar. The mainspring makes 20% more torque to drive the more torque-intensive perpetual calendar module. I love it outside, too. The angular case of the 5236P is a wonderful homage to the references 3448 and 3450, the perpetual calendars that were made from the 1960s through the 1980s. We've got that same sharp angular set of lugs and conical bezel, and it really is a wonderful tribute without being a retro watch. It references Patek's history without plagiarizing it. And I would go so far as to say that if I were to drop 14,000, well, times 10 on a watch today, 140 grand, this would be the watch. Think about that. $14,000 gets you a Blancpain 50 Fathoms. With some negotiation, you could pay that at a boutique and get a 50 Fathoms new. You'll pay 10 times that to get this Patek Philippe, and if I were in the financial position to do it, I would throw my money at the Patek dealer. In fact, Brian Goffberg, who works at our company, is a Patek dealer, so I'd wind up throwing my money at him, and I don't think I would get a discount of any kind, and I'd be happy to do so. But here's what I hate about the 5236P. First, Patek classes this watch as a grande complication, which, as we noted in my previous episodes of Watches Tonight, simply isn't the case. The only wristwatch grand complication that Patek Philippe makes right now is the 5208. And that is a perpetual calendar, a minute repeater, and a chronograph. And traditionally, that is the definition of a grand complication. It's at least a chronograph, preferably a flyback or a split, plus a perpetual calendar and a minute repeater. Having only a perpetual calendar, the 5236P is not a grand complication. Instead, Patek uses this to describe a family of its most complicated and expensive watches, but it's deceptive and it's not technically accurate, nor is it historically true. Second, despite the patented dual coaxial coplanar calendar discs on this watch, the complication module is neither integrated into the base movement nor ambitious in its design. So everyone knows that an integrated complication is designed at the same time as the movement that drives it. So all these elements will sit in the same plane rather than putting a stack of bridges and plates on top of another stack of bridges and plates. So this particular Patek perpetual calendar is a calendar system on the top and a driving automatic on the bottom. They're not integrated, and the watch is thicker and less graceful for that lack of refinement. Also, the calendar is controlled by case flank pusher correctors. Now, you know on perpetual calendars, there's a couple of different ways to adjust them. The IWC system can be adjusted entirely from the crown, and it's mechanically programmed, so you can never make up an imaginary combination of day, date, month, leap year, and moon phase. Whereas with independent pusher correctors for each indication, the day, the date, the month, the leap year, the moon phase, you can absolutely get the calendar display on the 5236P out of sync. And there are even better crown-setting perpetual calendars than the one you'll find on the IWC system. Ludwig Oxlin and Ulysse Nordin, which uses the Oxlin system, have perpetual calendars that you can set in both directions using only the crown. Pusher correctors on the Patek for each individual display that require special corrector tools that come with the watch as an accessory, this is perpetual calendar technology that Henri Stern would have recognized back in the 1940s. In fact, it dates back to the pocket watch era, and it's just not acceptable on a watch of this price from a company of Patek Philippe's stature. And it also uses a system called the Grand Levier, or the Grand Lever. That's a combination of levers and wheels. that have been used on perpetual calendars since probably the early 19th, late 18th century, a long, long time, predating wristwatches by centuries. So this Grand Levier system is effective, but it's also space inefficient, and it limits the functionality of the perpetual calendar, making it difficult to incorporate things like crown setting or bidirectional setting. We're now two generations removed from Henri Stern in Patek Philippe family leadership, but that system endures, and frankly, it's time to move on. I love the 5236P. It's beautiful. I adore its movement. I adore perpetual calendars. It's everything I want in a watch. And yes, I can even reconcile myself to the price, because a Patek Philippe watch like that will hold its value. It's worth what they're asking, but it could be even better. I would also say, realistically, the watch doesn't have enough power reserve. You notice how a lot of perpetual calendar watches, especially those from the likes of Moser, have really long power reserves. Well, that only makes solid sense, because when a very complicated watch stops, you've got a lot of correcting to do, especially since Patek has this piecemeal and cumbersome setting perpetual calendar system. So you've only got a 48-hour power reserve in the 5236P, which means that, for the most part, this is going to stop if you leave it for much more than a day. You're not going to make it through the second night. And frankly, there was a time in the not-too-distant past when Patek made twin-barrel movements with 8 to 10 days of power reserve on watches like the 5100, the 5101, and the 5200. And frankly, I believe the longest power reserve Patek offers now is 3 days in the Grandmaster Chime, a multi-million-dollar watch that's almost 50 millimeters in diameter. We need longer power reserves in Patek calendar watches. I would also say that the 5236P is just huge for a dress watch, borderline too big. It's 41.3 millimeters, and it has those strikingly large angular lugs from the 3448, so it wears its size on the wrist. It doesn't wear small for its size. Those lugs seem to add 2 millimeters to the case on the wrist. It really looks like a 43-millimeter watch. All of this said, I would gladly shove my $140,000 into Terry Stern's hands if I were in a position to do so, because my eagerness to forgive this watch is rivaled only by Hollywood's readiness to forgive the next Mel Gibson blow-up. Okay. Watches I love but also hate. Some things are so ugly, we find them intriguing and irresistible, like pug and bulldog puppies. And that's exactly how I feel about the Debitune DBD. Launched in 2006, the DB Digital was an evolution of the prior DBS model. The DBD featured a 6-day power reserve, a digital inline calendar, not a perpetual, but still day, date, and month inline, the first use of that system on a wristwatch. It had jumping hours and a case back with a spherical moon phase made of one-half palladium, one-half blued steel, and that had a setting interval of once every 1,112 years. So it's an inline calendar, a jump hour, a 6-day power reserve, and a nearly perpetual moon phase. Dial side, this watch features Côte de Genève, or stripes, a pendant-like shape. So if you can imagine a pendant watch, just like that. And the watch has reasonably good small wrist fit, making it the most wearable of the generally oversized digital time Debitune timepieces. And if Debitune is my favorite brand, and it is, the DBD is my favorite Debitune. That should tell you how much I adore the reference. So what's not to love about this watch? Let's start with rarity. The DBD was made in only 39 copies, of which a mere 17 were the white gold variant that I desire. Happiness, I've decided, is being a Rolex fan, because almost everything the company has made was made by the millions. Prices may vary and weights may vary, but purchase opportunities are not lacking. If you have the money, you can go online and buy any Rolex model right now, as long as you're cool with the markup. With the DBD, there may not be one on the market, and there might not be one on the market for a really long time. We've only had one at Watchbox and Watch You Want in the 8 years I've been doing this, and it was the rose gold one that I don't want. When is one of those 17 going to come around, the 17 white gold models? Well, I think never might be a good guess. So this is a scarcity. Granted, if I were to own the watch, the scarcity would be a point in its favor, but from the buyer's standpoint, it can be frustrating. Then there's the DBD's market price, which is approaching, wait for it, $200,000, when even the moderately more available rose gold model comes to market. So think about that. We all understand that our appetite for watches always exceeds our means, and nowhere is that more true than in the case of a Grail watch. And for me, this is the Grail watch defined as a watch that will always be out of reach, whereas the 5236P perpetual calendar from Patek is a Grail watch defined as something that will require years of planning and life priority choices in order to afford. Not impossible, but remote. The DBD is impossible. And in spite of the premium pricing, the DBD is only a complex calendar. Like I mentioned, its inline calendar display is not a perpetual, it's not an annual calendar. Then there is the dial. It's not the most efficient use of space. Yeah, you've got scrolling minutes, a jumping hour, and an inline calendar, but this is probably the lowest area to utilization of any modern watch dial I've encountered, and it's fair to call the dial of the watch barren. Patek did a much better job packaging its moon phase, inline calendar, and time display in a way that still let the watch look as though it had a full, purposeful dial. There wasn't a lot of negative, unused space. With the DBD, that's a real problem. And then there's the look of the DBD, because this watch has been called everything from a bathroom scale to a tombstone. And this watch definitely looks like the latter. It's a bit of an unintentional memento mori, and I'm not a fan of the memento mori watch genre. Maybe this explains why the watch is so rare in the first place. It was expensive new, and a lot of folks thought that it was kind of ugly. But, like those ugly bulldog and pug puppies I mentioned, the DBD is something I love more for its distinctive appearance, not less. Sometimes true love is blind of necessity. If I wind up winning the lottery, rest assured, that white gold DBD will be on my wrist. And if I can't find one, my company owns De Batoon, I'll pay them to make me a piece unique. And then I'll get the platinum case with the green dial, and they can call it the Tim Masso. Remote, you better believe it. But hope springs eternal. Okay, up next is a watch that's far more accessible, both new and pre-owned, and one that many of you may have considered purchasing at some point. The Blancpain 50 Fathoms, and by that I mean the reference 5015. A little backstory. This is important because a lot of the appeal of this watch lies in its history and its heritage. The original was launched in 1953 alongside the Rolex Submariner. The 50 Fathoms was, jointly with the Submariner, one of the two models that launched the modern dive watch format and genre. In case you're wondering, 50 Fathoms, approximately 300 feet of water resistance. Fast forward to today, the 50 Fathoms is the face of the Blancpain brand. It combines real history with a caliber 1315 movement that is both artisanal and long-legged. The overall finish, the opulent details, the level of care put Audemars Piguet and Rolex dive watches to shame. This is a high luxury product. There's shock resistance, magnetic resistance, a 5-day power reserve courtesy of 3 automatically wound mainspring barrels. You have beautiful execution with bevels a mile wide and a movement that's designed to embrace its modernity. Rather than vintage evocative Côte de Genève, it has a lovely spiral, deep graining, almost like the dial of a Chopard Alpine Eagle. So imagine that finish on a movement. That's the 1315. It also has awesome lume. The whole bezel is lumed, and it has a charismatic cambered sapphire-capped dive bezel that looks like it's perpetually covered in water. Very, very neat. While Rolex has hardly touched its Daytona since the 2000s, there's nothing overt about that watch, the Daytona, that screams decade from hell, which the 2000s definitely were. So the Daytona has aged gracefully, but the Blancpain 50 Fathoms certainly looks like it was designed back in the 2000s. As appealing as the caliber 1315 is, You can't see it on the steel versions of the 5015, which generally include solid case backs, and because of the era in which it was designed, the 2000s, the 5015 is huge. Its bulk at 45 millimeters is undeniable, and though its history is long and distinguished, just as is the Rolex Submariner, the massive size of the circa 2007 50 Fathoms 5015 means that it will never be directly comparable to or competitive with the Rolex in the marketplace. The size and image of the watch is just too incompatible. The size is massive. The polish is garish. This is a watch that's designed to make a huge statement in a way few collectors still want to in the year 2023. And then size has another disadvantage. Fit, for me, is tight. It's 50.6 millimeters from lug to lug. It's thick. It's bulky. I can barely just wear the watch, despite adoring its story, assembly quality, and superb movement. And for all the talk of the Blancpain X71 bracelet's superior assembly, feel, and integrity, the bracelet lacks any kind of a dive extension, which is a huge miss, given that this is practically a $20,000 watch when the bracelet is included. Even a $3,500 Oris Aquis gives you at least a fold-out dive extension. Rolex and Omega include highly adjustable, variable extension clasps on their divers, and both charge a lot less than Blancpain. In fact, even the Tudor Pelagos, a $4,600 diver, that's $4,600, includes multiple degrees of adjustment in its diving clasp. Plus, when you buy the Pelagos, you also get a free accessory rubber strap to go with it. Now, help is on the horizon. Since the 70th anniversary, 50 Fathoms is riding to the rescue with what appears to be a regular production 42.3 millimeter case and a display case back. Add a smaller case, solid blocks of loom for numerals, and keep all the best features of the previous watch, which I understand the new one does. It's a limited edition for now, but expect a regular production version soon without the commemorative dial text once the 2023 70th anniversary year for the 50 Fathoms is done. Now, Audemars Piguet is probably the brand I love/hate the most of any. Aside from Patek Philippe, there's probably no brand besides AP that I hold to higher standards of innovation, quality, and respect for its own history. Which brings me to my subject watch. I love the 1991 Audemars Piguet Star Wheel with a white hot passion. It was innovative, fine, beautiful, poetic, and exactly the kind of watch that made AP part of the Swiss Holy Trinity long before Le Brassu was cranking out octagonal sports watches. And I was an early proponent of the Code 1159, despite its slow start with other watch enthusiasts. I also love aventurine glass. Where am I going with this? Well, it should come no shock to you that I adore the 2022 Code 1159 Star Wheel. It is the Wandering Hours aventurine glass dial, an actual dress watch design, and a big win for AP. Think about the last time AP had an actual dress watch design win. It's been a while. This scores. It's not too thick either at 10.7 millimeters, so it's got everything I want, and at $57,900, it isn't even the kind of cash gouge we've come to expect from hot new Audemars Piguet releases. The coaxial center seconds hand is also a new twist on the traditional AP Star Wheel. Previously, we didn't have that. And the dial side carousel for the satellite hours is finished in gorgeous fashion. Again, I cannot get over a bed of aventurine underpinning all of this. So what's not to love? Lots. Let's start with the size. At 41 millimeters, this doesn't sound huge, but the 50 millimeter lug-to-lug span makes every basic Code 1159 model wear like a 43 millimeter watch. Everyone I know who tries a Code for the first time remarks that the case is more beautiful than they expected, thinner than they expected, and the watch is more appealing in person than in photos. Without exception, they also comment negatively on the watch size and the proportions of the lugs, which almost everyone equates to a sports watch. The size and proportions of the lugs will run out right to the edge of your wrist, even if you have an average-sized wrist. However, at 30 meters maximum, this is no sports watch. You cannot get it wet. Second, there's that price. It sounds fair at $57,900 for what you're getting. But AP announced last year it would become the first major luxury watch brand to allow its own stores, that's factory boutiques, to apply, quote, market adjustments to the company's suggested retail price. So, if they decide they can get more than $57,900 at retail, expect to pay that even in an AP boutique. If they can get 70 grand, expect to pay 70 grand buying it new. Finally, there's the delicate fashion of the dial's execution, and it doesn't carry over to the reverse of the case. All of the fine finish and the premium materials are concentrated on the dial side, which is justifiable in a sense, but you would expect it to be at least as fine on the reverse, given that this is a nearly $60,000 watch. Audemars Piguet automatic caliber 4309 has decent technical specs. It's durable. It's got a 3-day power reserve, but largely mechanical execution in terms of finishing is comparable to brands like JLC, Zenith, Glashütte Original, and maybe Moser. It's not Vacheron, Lange, or Patek level. Even upstart independents like Laurent Ferrier, Moritz Grossman, and Chapek do a better job sweating the movement details and making their own $60,000 watches look truly handmade and hand-finished. With its resources, AP should do better. Blancpain's 1315 movement is finished well, better in a dive watch that costs less than one-third the price of the Code Star wheel. Think about that. Blancpain's sports watch automatic in a watch costing one-third the price is better finished than the automatic movement in the Code 1159 Star wheel. These companies, Blancpain and Audemars Piguet, are close neighbors. The reverse of the Code 1159 looks like every other watch with a 4300 automatic base. Somehow, Blancpain's 16-year-old caliber 1315 had 5 days of power reserve to the new AP's 3 days, and the older movement has superior finish despite mostly powering a $15,300 steel dive watch. So, where does that leave me? Well, all of the watches featured in today's show are profoundly flawed. I feel about these watches exactly how I feel about my other purely emotional commitment, cars. I've blown irrational money on cars, and I do it again to connect with what I love. There's no rational way to explain why a person, myself included, should pursue car experiences and watch collecting instead of saving for old age, investing in mutual funds, ETFs, inflation-protected T-bills, and houses that, frankly, I just don't want to own. But I always come back to cars and watches because that's where my passion lies. And passion is not a rational emotion. Just as importantly, it's not an optional emotion. As human beings, we need it. Guys, find me on YouTube, Watchbox Reviews and Watchbox Studios, and on Instagram, Tim_Masso. Time out, Tim out, where your watch is in the best of health, and thanks for logging on.